So you're looking at the Sinai Peninsula, as you know, and that's the Nile River. And there's the Nile goes in all kinds of directions there. And here is possibly Mount Sinai. No one knows exactly where it was, but that's the traditional site. And the people wandered in this area here for a generation, 40 years, then made their way over and entered through there. So that's where we'll be. That map I'll put up a few times. That'll be where we're watching as we journey through the book of Exodus. So I start. Irish MSC, who's died since he wrote this, Michael Marr, in a book called When God Formed a People, speaking of the Exodus, has this to say. It's obvious that a book which tells of redemption, Passover, covenant, law, sin and forgiveness, divine grace and human response, and of God's presence among us, must have meaning for the Christian to whom all these themes are familiar. This will be the most important thing I say tonight to you, and I hope you're happy with it. If not, help me make you happy with it. Prior to the Greek period, so that's the late 4th century, Alexander the Great going through this whole area, writers in the ancient Near East, though just as interested in reality, of course, they generally expressed their insights not in history, but in epic, saga, song and story. That's in the Greek world, the ancient Greek world, Homer you may have read. It's the ancient Roman world, it's the ancient every world. This is how they communicate what was meaningful to them. The Aborigines still do it, and simpler cultures are doing it all the time. The Irish love it. Poetry, drama, story. Jesus loved it. The parables, the stories. Other writings from the ancient world chose the elevated, poetic and sophisticated style of epic literature. A style that was typical of an aristocratic and ruling class. Not so Israel. In the Bible, we find more popular stories, a more popular style, open to everyone. It's the style of storytelling. This style links immediately with experience. It provides a simple and effective way of sharing experience and so sharing truth. So this brings us to a key insight that we must have as we approach the story of the Exodus from Egypt and the entry into the Promised Land. And this insight is that for the most part, the Old Testament offers us truth as truth is expressed in story. The stories draw on facts, the facts of people's lives and memories and experience, yes. But only rarely do we find in them what we would regard as history. We've learned, and it's a good thing to have learned through the Enlightenment and so on, we've learned to distinguish between history, which is all footnoted and proved from libraries and checked and got the facts, you know. And then we have a thing called drama, which you don't put that in history books. And we have poetry, and we have epic, and we have dance, and we have all kinds of stuff. We make all those distinctions. They didn't. They wanted to communicate the truth of their life and their life experience, and they do it with everything jumbled in together. And basically, they do it through story. Those responsible for the Exodus story, and you find that story in the book of Exodus, the book of Numbers, and the book of Deuteronomy, were interested in history in the sense that they were interested in real people and their real lives. But their aim was to connect their contemporaries with the precious religious insights that had come down to them from their ancestors. And they used folklore, legend, when this helped to achieve their aim. Like all the writings of the ancient Near East, all of them were like this, they drew on oral tradition, stories told by grandpa, and he got them from his grandfather and grandmother and so on. So they drew on oral tradition, and the aim of oral tradition is ongoing interest, not historical accuracy. I'm a Fallon, and my father told me we were descended from the kings of Ireland. I thought that was pretty good. I later found out that everyone on every hill was called a king, and we came from Knockrockery, which means hangman's hill. In any case, there was something nice as a boy thinking you came from royalty. Okay, stories communicated something, I suppose, about the interest in our family that people had. I'm now going to quote from a Jew, because that's pretty important. He's written a lovely book called The Art of Biblical Narrative. This is the conclusion of his book, which has got 150 pages or so pages in it. I'll read it to you. It's a very lovely way of saying what I'm trying to say to you. And this insight is essential, or we're not going to understand any of the book of Exodus. The Hebrew writers manifestly took delight in the artful liming, I had to look up the dictionary to see, depicting, basically, of these lifelike characters and actions. And so they created an inexhaustible source of delight for 100 generations of readers. Brackets. Samson. Oh, God, what a story. Daniel. What a story. David. You got it? These are all powerful stories. There might be no facts in them, but they're powerful stories about what it means to be a prophet, what it means to be a king, what we should be if we're going to be a king who's obedient to God, you know? So we see David doing this and not doing this and doing that and doing something else, and nobody knows what David did. All we know is that he existed. That's all the facts we've got. But he's obviously a great, like the Mujahideen or something, he's a great bully living up on the mountaintop, and he had surrounded by something. And the stories come down, but the stories, I'm still in brackets, this is not alto now, the stories are there for the present king to learn how to be a king from these stories about David who lived 400 years earlier or something. Back to alto. The pleasure of imaginative play is deeply interfused with a sense of great spiritual urgency. The biblical writers fashion their personages with a complicated, sometimes alluring, often fiercely insistent individuality. Because it's in the stubbornness of human individuality that each man and each woman encounters God or ignores God, responds to God or resists God. So they're marvelously living characters. And he concludes, subsequent religious tradition has by and large encouraged us to take the Bible seriously rather than to enjoy it. But the paradoxical truth of the matter, says Robert Alter, may well be that by learning to enjoy the biblical stories more fully as stories, we shall also come to see more clearly what they mean to tell us about God, about being a human being, and the perilously momentous realm of history. Enjoying them as stories, we can see what the author was wanting to tell us about behavior, life, God. Got it? And then God's influence in our world. History, this is now my point, history was a way of understanding their destiny in the world as a people special to Yahweh. To be an Israelite is to share the faith of a people who believe that God liberates from slavery and that the way to receive the special blessings promised them by God is to listen to Yahweh and do the will of Yahweh. They're pretty basic lessons, and they're really important, and they're all there in this book of Exodus. The biblical writers are not seeking to give their readers historically accurate information about their past. They're interested in forming the consciousness of the nation by keeping before them the stories that remind them of who they are and what they're called to be. Their explicit focus was not on accurate historical detail, but on the way they understood God to have acted in the past and to be acting in the present, and on how they are to respond if they want to receive the blessing of God. Let's have a look at what Canaan was like before Palestine was like before they entered. The book of Deuteronomy on the left-hand side reads, chapter 7, when Yahweh your God brings you future into the land that you are about to enter and occupy, and he clears away many nations before you, and he names some of them, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Seven nations mightier and more numerous than you, and when Yahweh your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must utterly destroy them. Any echoes there of what's happening by the Islamists in Syria? And there's a lot of this stuff in the Bible as well, you know, if they take it literally. We're going to see tonight that no one was killed. But that's another matter. I'll do that a bit later. So defeat them. God's going to defeat them. Destroy them. And make no covenant with them. And show them no mercy. That's God's words, we say at the end. The word of the Lord. And everyone says, thanks be to God. And then we go on to the next bit of the Mass. So hang on. Weinfeld, a scholar, says, just to give you the background to our times, the Hittites constituted an empire in Anatolia, what we now call Turkey, and Syria in the 15th and 14th centuries before the Common Era, or as I'd like to say, before Christ. After the collapse of the Hittite Empire at the end of the 13th century, when the Sea Peoples attacked the Anatolian and Syrian coast, there came down to Palestine hosts of refugees and immigrants consisting of various ethnic groups, including, and I put in blue the ones that are over here as well, including Hittites, Jebusites, Hivites, and Girgashites, who settled in the densely populated areas in the hill country. They seized power in the few existing cities in the mountains, such as Shechem, Gibeon and Hebron. So the collapse of central Turkey led to people fleeing south, but they were armed and they were pretty strong groups, and they came into this area and took hilltops and took control, and they were foreigners. This is before Moses and Joshua at the entrance of the... Here's the book of Ezekiel 16:3. Thus says the Lord Yahweh to Jerusalem, your origin and your birth were in the land of Canaanites. Your father was an Amorite, your mother a Hittite. So they're descended from these groups, and they acknowledged it. You are the Jewish people coming from these various tribal groups that came south. The Jebusites, we know, controlled Jerusalem till David captured the city and made it the capital of the United Kingdom. So there's a map of Palestine with the names, you can just look at them, that I've mentioned, and I'll read to you what I've got on the left there. To get some idea of the early history of Israel, we turn to the discoveries of archaeology. That's been the real breakthrough for biblical studies. Because archaeology doesn't lie. It does have to be interpreted. But they've sifted through the whole land of Palestine. And they can work out how many people were there, how many city towns were there, what the populations were, give or take, you know. So, our earliest glimpse into Canaan comes from the Amarna tablets from the 14th century before Christ, which consist in correspondence between Egypt, the great Egypt, and the cities in Canaan. Notably, they've got letters to Jerusalem, Shechem, Megiddo, Hatzor, and Lachish. And what these tablets, these letters, reveal is that the cities were quite weak. They were paying heavy tribute to their Egyptian overlord. They had no city walls and consisted of little more than a palace, a temple compound, and a few public buildings. The Egyptian provincial capital was at Gaza, and there were Egyptian garrisons in Joppa and Beth Shan. Gaza, Joppa, and Beth Shan. Garrisons from Egypt. And these other places were paying tribute to them to go back to the Pharaoh of Egypt. Now, from the Bible itself, it's impossible to establish a date for the Exodus. 1 Kings chapter 6, 1 places it as 480 years prior to the fourth year of Solomon's reign. Couldn't be clearer. In other words, about 1436 before Christ. But such a date poses too many problems. No scholar agrees with that date. And now look at this. When it's recognized that 480 is 12 by 40, 12 is the heavenly zodiac, you know, the 12 tribes of Egypt, of Israel, of Jacob, the 12 apostles. 12 is that heavenly fullness. And 40 is a generation, you know, 40 years in the desert. And so when 480 is 12 by 40, don't you smell the fact that you're probably dealing with a symbolic number, not an accurate historical record? Of course. Now, a more likely historical background for the Exodus story is the late 13th century. Ramses II, whom we've got a little statue of him there, and the Egyptians, the bigger the statue, the more important the person. That's his wife. So it was a fairly male-dominated society, which won't be much of a surprise. Well, thank God we haven't got a male-dominated society here tonight. You've got the numbers, use them. So that's that. He undertook a massive building program in the delta of the Nile. We know this historically. We've got, because the sea peoples, now the sea peoples, you've all have heard the Battle of Troy, you know about the breakdown, that's western Turkey, and the breakdown of the Mycenaean Empire. Well, it was a whole clash of cultures going on, and there were sea peoples come from all those broken areas. sailors coming, looking for wives, of course, and life and something on these boats. They can't go home anymore. And these sea peoples ravage the coasts of Egypt and Syria. So we're going to see that one of the sea peoples were the Philistines, and we know about from the Bible. Now, we know that Ramses II used slave labor. It was at the end of his long reign that the small Canaanite states sustained by Egyptian power collapsed, because Egypt was too busy defending itself against the sea peoples. This entailed the liberation of some local populations from the slavery of Egyptian rule. I'm talking about places like Jerusalem, Shechem, Beersheba, you know, that part of Canaan. I'm not talking about Egypt for a minute. But they were free now because Egypt didn't have the power to control them as much as it did. Now, there was an age-old rhythm of migration of people from Egypt to Canaan. Egypt was watered, as you know, by the Nile, whereas Canaan depended on rainfall for its crops. And when the rains failed, they sought help from their neighbour, Egypt. In the 13th century, there were Canaanites in Egypt for purposes of trade and as prisoners of war. Furthermore, in an attempt to ward off the incursions of the sea peoples, Pharaoh Ramses II was building fortified cities in the land of Goshen. The land of Goshen is here, in the delta, the part nearest to Canaan, in the eastern delta of the Nile. And he was using forced labour of refugees, and the refugees are called, in Semitic language, Habiru. Habiru, can you hear the word Hebrew there? Habiru were people who were stateless. They had no home, no state. They were prisoners of war, and they were going between places, and they're all over, refugees. They were stateless, they were without any protection against the mercenary armies, pillaging their way through the Near East and profiting from the ready market for slaves. The book of Exodus states that the Israelites in Egypt, this is a quote, we'll look at it again when it comes, but the book of Exodus says the Israelites were more numerous and more powerful than the Egyptians. Exodus chapter 1 verse 9. Can you believe that as a matter of fact? Well, how can we accept this as a fact when we can find not one single reference in Egyptian literature to Israelites even existing in Egypt? They got records of everything. You'd think they'd think, oh my God, we're being overtaken by the Israelites. But you can't find it anywhere. No one said it. It wasn't happening. But it's in the Bible. So you've got to get rid of this idea that you're getting accurate historical information here. You're getting a big story, a wonderful, powerful, energizing story. Okay. We do know that there was frequent contact between Canaan and Egypt. And there would have been people from Canaan in Egypt, but they never outnumbered the Egyptians. Nor were they ever seen as a threat to the greatest of the pharaohs, Ramses II. Pharaoh Ramses II fortified and closely controlled the border with Canaan. As Finkelstein and Silbermann, Finkelstein is a Jewish archaeologist, Silbermann is a Jewish historian. So they're writing and they say, the escape of more than a tiny group from Egyptian control at the time of Ramses II seems highly unlikely, as is the crossing of the desert and the entrance into Canaan. Highly unlikely. I've got more to say to that in a minute. Except for the Egyptian forts along the northern coast, Not a single campsite or sign of occupation from the time of Ramses II and his immediate predecessors and successors has ever been identified in Sinai. Not even a single sherd, broken piece of pottery. None. And they have raked right through it. Signs of habitation in the Sinai Peninsula from the 3rd millennium, 3000 BC, have been found, but not from the 13th century. If the escaping slaves were at Kadesh Barnea, which they claim to have been here, if the escaping slaves were at Kadesh Barnea, they left no trace. There are no traces either at Ezion Geber there, where the Book of Numbers will tell us that they went. Nothing, no sign there, no sign there. In the 13th century BC, Arad, which is mentioned in the Book of Exodus, Arad was deserted. There's nobody there. Heshbon, that's not on that map, the city of the famous Sihon, Sihon king of the Amorites and Og king of Bashan, we have it in the Psalms. Heshbon didn't exist in the 13th century BC, just as Sydney, CBD, didn't exist in 1500. Edom and Ammon, the great enemies of later Israelites, not at the time of Moses, these two were sparsely populated by nomadic tribes. They weren't kingdoms. Oh, the way you're looking at me, you're wondering why you came. And you're thinking that I'm going to upset. No, by the end of it, you'll love this. But I'm just trying to tell you that you're not finding history in the Bible. You're finding something far more significant than history. Factual history. There's more to come. Though we have no evidence of a significant group of slaves escaping from Egypt, there is nothing to contradict that such escapes happened. But, Exodus 12:37, 600,000 men plus women and kids escaped from Egypt. Do you think they would have noticed? Do you think somebody would have sent a telegram to somebody saying, hey, there seems to be a lot happening? Add the women and children, think of the supplies needed, and factor in that archaeology hasn't found one trace of their presence in the Sinai. So give us a break. 600,000 are like a Cecil B. DeMille film. And they look powerful. Now let's have a look at the plagues of Egypt. You know all about that. You taught kids this at school, and they're wonderful. And you don't go around, please, and I wouldn't either, you don't go around telling the kids, oh, this didn't really happen, it's only a story. You tell the story. They'll work it out. The problem with us is, me included, and many of you probably, our problem was that when we got old enough to ask the question, oh, was it true? Our teachers didn't know, so they said yes. That was the problem for us. So we as adults have often still got the yes in our heads. I asked my mother, God, I'm embarrassed to tell you this, I think I was 9 before I was the last one in the class to stop believing in Santa Claus. Because I believed in Santa Claus. And I proved it too, I have to tell you, because we're having an argument in the class, and I knew because I got a dinky toy, you know, one of those little tiny little cars, for Christmas. And we had 8 kids. Dad had a job, but we had to grow up on nothing. So they bought me socks and underpants and whatever I needed. But a dinky toy? So I remember telling the class, here's me proof. Because Mum and Dad aren't that stupid. That must be Santa Claus. So I went up to Sister Maria Joseph, who was a Josephite. Where are the Josephites? Yeah, all right, well, Did you ever know Sister Maria Joseph? I don't know what her surname was. Now, I said, but it was lovely, really, because I don't want to tell you too much. We'll be here all night. But as a kid, I used to be talkative, I couldn't not know the answers to things. I used to drive my mad, I think. So she used to send me down the chooks behind the head to look at the chooks. And she said, you watch the chooks. Every time they take a drink, they look up and thank God. So I went down and I knew chooks like no one knew chooks. And my God, my mother was right. Never once did they take a drink without thanking God. And I was very impressed. But I also saw their eyes. And chooks have got a little bit of something under the eyelid. They've got an eyelid and then underneath they've got a bit of, I don't know what it is, it closes, but before, not the eyelid, little bit of translucent stuff there. I knew chooks really well. So, and this is going to sound funny, but when I went to Sister Maria, I said, Sister Maria, Santa Claus did exist, didn't he? And the same thing happened to her eyes that happens to the chooks. Now, it couldn't have been that, but in other words, she was, little kids see into your soul, see? And I was looking in, and I don't know what she said, but it was a bit edgy. It was a bit neither this nor that, but I just remember the look in her eye and I thought, she's hiding something from me. So I went back to Mum, and Mum then told me about Christmas and Mary's, 9 months till the birth, a whole lot I got. And I was happy, that was all right, I didn't mind it. Because now I'd asked the question, but I'd found out from my mother, but can you imagine how it would have been if my mother said, oh yes, there is a Santa Claus. When I was ready to ask the question, I got the right answer. No one gave to me before I was ready. Then I went out to my little sister. I didn't mean to spoil the fun, but I just did. I was just scatterbrained. And she was 20 months younger than me. And I went out to see her. I said, Margaret, do you know that Santa Claus doesn't exist? She said, I've known for years. She'd known for years, but she didn't tell because we got this presents. See, we got little things in stockings and things that the older ones didn't get. And that was my first insight into this feminine bloody duplicity. And I think I owe my vocation to that. I thought, celibacy for you, Mick. No, I didn't. But anyhow, I am saying something really serious there. I'm trying to say, don't let's tell the story as a story. And if a child is ready to ask the question, did that really happen? Then you give them the right answer. We were given the wrong answer in religious matters because everyone thought it's true and it's important, you know what I mean? So it's a fact. We thought true means fact. Well, look at Shakespeare. Enjoy truth coming from poetry. But anyhow, here we are. The plagues of Egypt. The imagery for the first 9 plagues is drawn from natural phenomena. All of them. Isn't this all we need to know? As a story, it would have spoken powerfully to people who experienced such plagues. Do we need to read the text as giving us historically reliable facts? Namely, that someone in the late 13th century, over a short period, some time, God intervened to produce all these plagues through Moses in a few weeks. Nor should we miss the point, the powerful drama which we'll look at, that in the first plague, Yahweh defeats the god of the Nile. Blood, the Nile goes to blood. The god of the Nile is Hapi, one of the highest of the gods of Egypt. Can you see what's happening? They're saying Yahweh is stronger than the gods of Egypt. They believed in the gods of Egypt, people who wrote this. They were polytheists, of course. You know that from your first commandment. I am the Lord your God. You shall not put strange gods before me. They weren't monotheists. But they said, our God is the highest God and the most important one, and you must worship him. But they presumed all these other people had their gods too. Well, Hapi was defeated. And in the 9th plague, which is darkness came over the whole land, over the sun, the highest God in the Egyptian gods is Ra. Ramses means the son of Ra. Well, the sun god is blackened out by Yahweh. You can feel it, can't you? Our God is the God that creates the world, and there are no gods before him, is all being said in this story. But these kind of plagues happen every now and then. Exodus describes the crossing of the Red Sea, the Yam Suf in Hebrew. Suf can mean reed, and there's a couple of Exodus Isaiah passages where it does mean a reed. But do we need to try to make the story more plausible as history by translating the text as the Reed Sea? And imagining that the authors of the Exodus are describing a crossing that took place in a marshy area somewhere between the western arm of the Red Sea and the Mediterranean. That's quite possible, by the way, but let's leave it there. Or can we leave Red Sea in the text and let the drama of the story carry its full weight? And the full weight, you know the story, is they walked through and the water, wasn't it, standing to the left and the right. Excuse me, I'm going to have a sneeze. We're meant to be amazed by the story, but it's not a fact. There are allusions to the creation and the flood narratives, which give the sea an almost mythical character. God is once again conquering chaos. Genesis chapter 1, the swirling waters and the darkness, and the Spirit hovers over the deep. And then God says, shh, let there be light, let there be, etc. And God brings order to the chaos. Well, the Red Sea crossing is God once again bringing order to the chaos, the uncontrollable elements of the sea. Do we have to believe as a historical fact, quote, the waters formed a wall for the Israelites on their right and on their left, but that they returned and covered the chariots and the chariot drivers, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea, not one of them remained? So there goes Ramses II, and there goes all his captains and all his chariots, because they're all there, and all his army. And there's not one record of it in the Egyptian libraries. You still with me? The 13th century was a tumultuous time throughout the ancient Near East. Empires clashed and collapsed. Armies of mercenary soldiers wrought havoc in the area. And with the collapse of the Mycenaean Empire in Egypt, in Greece, the sea peoples ravaged the shores of Egypt and Canaan. This is the book, The Bible Unearthed, Archaeology's New Vision of Ancient Israel and the Origins of Its Sacred Texts, Finkelstein, an Israeli archaeologist, and Silberman, an Israeli historian, write, the Ugaritic and Egyptian records of the early 12th century before the Common Era mention these marauders. There's historical evidence for them. A text found in the ruins of the port city of Ugarit, that's in Syria, north of Lebanon, to the king of Alashia, which is Cyprus, frantically describes, quote, how enemy boats have arrived, the enemy set fire to the cities and wrought havoc, my troops are in Hittite country, my boats in Lycia, and the country has been left to its own devices. That's a letter written by this down to Egypt. Likewise, a letter from the same period from the great king of Hatti to the prefect of Ugarit expresses his anxiety about the presence of a group of sea peoples called Shikalaya, who live on boats. 10 years later, in 1175, it was all over in the north. Hatti, Alashia, and Ugarit lay in ruins. But Egypt was still a formidable power, determined to make a desperate defence. The monumental inscriptions of Ramses II at the temple of Medinet Habu in Upper Egypt recount the sea people's purported conspiracy to ravage the settled areas of the eastern Mediterranean. This is all historical fact, record. A number of cities in Canaan were destroyed in the late 13th century, including the ones I've marked there, Debir, Bethel, Lachish, and Ahaz Hatzor. Now, this destruction could have been the result of clashes between Israel and the city-states, and that's how the book of Joshua describes them, written centuries later. Or it could also have resulted from the clash between Egypt and the Hittites, or the result of struggles between the city-states themselves, as trade was disrupted due to the ravages brought about at the time by the sea peoples, including the Philistines. So we do have records that seem to back up the Bible. Do you get me? The destruction of these places. By Joshua, says the Bible. Wait a minute, say the archaeologists. It could have been just a fight between them. It could have been the sea peoples. It could have been any number of reasons for the record of the burning and the ravaging of these towns. And this is so important for our biblical study. It's likely that the sea peoples themselves were the main cause of the destruction of the small city-states. They were in the north, they probably were in Canaan. And so of the need for the herders to escape the disorder of the plains, because they had iron, they could make spears, which the Israelites couldn't do it. They had spears, they had chariot wheels. Well, on the level plain, chariots are going to win every time. Get up into the mountains where they can't climb and you're more likely to be safe. So a lot of the people fled into the mountain areas, obviously. And the settlers in those hill country of Canaan, which is marked by that shadow, they're the tribes of Israel. They didn't come out of Egypt and come in and destroy all these people as God told them to do, if you read the Bible literally. The purpose of God telling them not to do is their way of saying, don't mix up your faith, don't lose your faith, don't intermarry and get caught up in all this paganism. Keep pure. That's what it's telling them to do. But it sounds like God told them to go in and slaughter all the locals. They are the locals. The tribes of Israel are there. They never went out of there. Something must have happened to them, which I'll talk about in a minute. But these were not coming from the desert in. They were coming up there because of the unsettled conditions that we talked about. Now, the oldest extant record of the existence of a people called Israel is an Egyptian stone inscription from the time of Merneptah, the son of the pharaoh Ramses II. Israel Finkelstein, in another article, notes evidence of an increase in settlement in the highlands of Canaan in the 13th century BC. So they can work out from the levels when it happened. The vast majority of people who settled in the hill country and in the Transjordan during the Iron One period must have been indigenous. I've been making that point, but there it is from a scholar. Is that okay? They must have been there, and they belonged there, and that was their home.